This is Joel Spolsky, the host of the Stack Overflow podcast. Our podcast depends on listeners like you, who aren't you because you're already listening, and we need more listeners like you. We don't have any kind of fancy marketing budget, so please, if you enjoy this podcast, tell your friends to subscribe. Thank you.
Feel happy? Feel loose? Alexa sounds nervous.
I'm not nervous for the podcast. I'm nervous for what comes after the podcast, but I'm okay.
That makes way more sense.
I am at the user conference for Pluralsight and minutes away from meeting former First Lady of the United States, Michelle Obama.
Wow.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
I'm trying not to cry during this podcast, but I'm very nervous.
We're going to try to make you cry, Alexa. That's our goal.
That's pretty easy, David.
This is the Stack Overflow podcast, episode 116, recorded Thursday, September 21st, 2017 at Stack Overflow headquarters in New York City, where more than 8 million people live in peace and enjoy the benefits of democracy, and also recorded in Florida, where more than 20 million people live most of their lives in glorious sunshine and only occasionally in mortal terror of 400-mile-wide megastorms. Today's podcast is brought to you by Oracle. Stack Overflow greatly appreciates Oracle's support for this podcast and for our developer community. You can learn more about everything that Oracle does for open source, Java, and developers like you at oracle.com/developers. On today's podcast, we have a very special guest crew from Stack Overflow. We have Vice President of Marketing, Alexa Scordato.
Howdy.
We have Engineering Manager and renowned dog whisperer, Matt Sherman.
Hello.
And product manager, yes, that is his real name, Joe Friend.
Hey, everyone.
As well as special guest with us today, Jonathan Lips, director of open source at Sauce Labs.
What's going on?
I'm your host, David Fullerton, filling in this week for Jay Hanlon, who was himself filling in this month for Joel Spolsky. Welcome, everyone, to the show.
Good to be here.
Great to be here.
All right. Well, let's kick things off by going to our Constitution question from last week. This one got a lot of attention. As you know, we are preparing a Constitution for Stack Overflow. Every week, we bring you a proposal that you, our listeners, decide whether that proposal becomes part of our new Constitution. Last week's proposal came from Twitter user Joe Stetch. Joe Steck. At @Joe_Stetch. Joe asked, is an OS background process, spelled D-A-E-M-O-N, pronounced daemon or daemon? Pro was daemon, as in the probably mythical creature of intense and unrelenting evil, or con daemon, as in Matt Damon, the decidedly non-mythical creature of intense and unrelenting good looks. Here with the results is guest news editor Matt Sherman.
Well, all right. So it turns out it's about 75% con. So people like daemon as a pronunciation for D-A-E-M-O-N, which is interesting. Why do we think that is? Is that mostly an affinity thing for Matt Damon? Did we sort of bias people by...
It's probably Matt Damon. I think that's probably where most programmers go when they read that word. No, I think it's probably the spelling. I mean, it's an unusual spelling for daemon, even though it's, I guess, technically pronounced daemon. Jonathan, what do you think? You weren't here last week, so you didn't get to weigh in.
My opinion is that it's for disambiguation. You run into a lot more demons in computer science than Matt Damon's, so you want to disambiguate this particular type of server process, right?
Got it. All right.
I have a completely different reason. I think it's in honor of my son, whose first name is actually Damon. So that's the reason.
That's probably it.
I think that's fair.
All right.
Definitely.
So the universe of podcast listeners has spoken. It is pronounced daemon. Everyone, please update your pronunciation. Do we have a winning tweet, Matt?
We do have a winning tweet. It is a winning tweet for the minority position, but we picked it as a winner because it is the best tweet, not necessarily the most correct. And it comes from our own Nick Craver. He won't get stickers because he's got enough already, but he voted daemon, D-E-E, for two reasons. One, most daemons are evil, very much like OS processes. And secondarily, daemons, D-A-M-O-N-S, cost a lot of money and time to save. As in so many movies, if you think of Bourne and other things in The Martian, I guess, daemon is pretty darn expensive.
The one where he saved all of China? Wasn't that a recent one?
Yeah, that's right. That also sounds expensive.
Yeah.
But he's also really good at math at Harvard.
Yeah, Goodwill Hunting. Yeah, that's right. You know.
All right. Well, Congratulations, Nick Craver. No stickers for you. And please get back to work and stop tweeting at the podcast. All right. We have a new Constitution question this week. This week's question comes from Twitterer JB. That's at JB4th. Fourth is in the programming language. And then the numeral four, never mind. JB's question, which I think sounds like has some urgency, is it okay to take your shoes off at the office?
Wow.
That's a great question.
Wow, Matt, you definitely have strong opinions about this.
Yeah, amazingly, I still have a job here. I don't do it that much anymore, but I used to do it quite a fair amount. And Michael Pryor, our former CFO here, now CEO of Trello and Atlassian, now that I think about it, he had very, very strong opinions against feet.
He did. I worked at Fog Creek with Michael, and I remember we had a policy wiki. And the policy wiki was a tiny company. It was basically empty. And it was like one of like four articles on the entire internal company policies was you must wear shoes while you're at work.
So no flip-flops in the summer at all.
No, flip-flops were okay. Strangely, it was something about like bare soles on, you know, office carpets or something. I didn't really understand it.
Right.
Was it that he didn't want to feel it and he imagined feeling it when he saw other people wearing bare feet, or did he not want their germs on the floor?
I just don't know. To this day, it remains a mystery.
I think he was just generally kind of grossed out by it. This was a very sort of visceral, emotional thing for Michael. So I think he was just like grossed out.
All right. So we can see why this is a pretty high stakes issue for a lot of our listeners. So please take to the Twitters and weigh in. We're going to say pro is yes, it is okay to take your shoes off, and con is no shoes are required. So pro if you are for people being allowed to take their shoes off, con if you are opposed to them taking their shoes off. So post your answer to Twitter using the hashtag Stack Overflow Podcast with either pro or con and your explanation, short but punny. The best explanation, whether on the winning side or the losing side, will be read on next week's podcast and win your very own Stack Overflow sticker, courtesy of the Stack Overflow Podcast. You also, like Twitter user JB, can submit your own idea for future constitutional amendments using that same aforementioned hashtag Stack Overflow Podcast, and your amendment may be featured on a future podcast. So thank you, JB. I look forward to the answers. All right, let's get to our guest, Jonathan Lipps, director of open source at Sauce Labs. Do I have that right?
That's right.
All right. Welcome to the show. Really excited to get to talk to you. So before we get into what you do at Sauce Labs, a question we like to start off asking all of our guests, just tell us how you got started in programming.
Yeah, absolutely. My first memory of programming was flipping through a GW basic programming language manual that came with a computer that my dad had brought home from work when I was, I don't know, I must have been 6, 7, something like that. And it was fairly strange, but I learned that you could run games on the computer. You know, eventually this was QBasic games like Gorilla.bass or
yes.
Snake.bass. And I just thought that was the coolest thing ever. And then you could look at the code and somehow the fact that these words on the screen, you know, made you able to like throw bananas at a monkey or whatever just blew my mind. And I was pretty much hooked ever since.
Yeah, it's amazing to me how many people have such a similar story to that. Got started with basic programs where you could play these games or whatever, and then you could literally open it up and look at the code and change it.
Yeah.
I had that same experience. It was such a almost like mind-blowing moment when you realized, oh, this is the code that's running this thing. I can change it and make it, you know, say my name or something.
And it was so fun because, you know, this was sort of before the internet, even before we were on bulletin board systems and whatnot. So the way that I would get new programs to write before I was really comfortable enough to write my own was to subscribe to magazines that would come with, you know, printed programs that you could type in the computer. And it was crazy.
And so you sat there and painstakingly typed in line by line all of those programs.
Indeed.
So cool.
And that is still what I do. I go to Stack Overflow, I painstakingly copy things into my computer and then make my computer do things.
Oh, nice. I feel like we should teach you about copy-paste, but I don't want to get into that right
now. Wait a second. What's that?
You know what? It's probably better for you to type them all out by hand. You probably learn a lot more about how they
learn
work.
The hard way.
Cool. So tell us about your work present day at Sauce Labs. What do you do there?
So Sauce Labs, for anyone who isn't familiar, is an automated testing cloud service. And so we enable people to run tests on Selenium, servers or Appium servers to run tests on web browsers and mobile platforms. So because we've built our technology on these open source projects, Selenium and Appium, we have a real vested interest in seeing those projects and the communities that support those projects really thrive and move forward and, you know, get more of the industry in terms of what people use to automate things. And so my job is basically keep those projects healthy, do what I can to help them out. My primary focus is on Appium because I'm also the project lead for that and wrote most of the code for Appium over the years. So spent a lot of time doing community management, community development, but then also just consulting with Sauce on our overall open source strategy, how we use open source, how we contribute back to it, and all those things.
It's really interesting. So you mentioned part of what you're thinking about, or maybe your sort of overarching mission, is keeping that open source community healthy. What does that look like? What are the kinds of things you think about there?
It's a lot. I would say that, you know, I haven't gotten it down to a science yet. There's a really cool group that just kind of launched called Chaos with two S's. Community Health and Analytics. Oh, I don't know. I forget the acronym, but it's all about defining what are the really important metrics to track for community health and open source projects. And this is something that a lot of people have thought about for a long time, but nobody has really gotten a proposal together of, hey, these are the things you should really look at, and these are the things which are nice vanity things but don't really matter for community health. So obviously, you know, really high up on community health is engagement from contributors, how many contributors you have, how diverse they are. You know, they're not all from the same company, how frequent the contributions are, how easy it is for people who never contributed for to contribute, how quickly they transition from their first, you know, pull request to their fifth to their 10th. There's a lot of things to look at in terms of community health. And then, of course, more fuzzy, less analytical things like what's the tone of conversation between people on your issue tracker, and how friendly and welcoming is it? Do people feel like they can ask questions? Do they get answers really responsively from maintainers or from other users? That kind of thing.
That's really interesting. It's funny listening to that. It sounds like so much of the kinds of things we worry about here, thinking about sort of the health of Stack Overflow and how people are contributing.
That's right. Yeah, you guys are maintaining a community that sounds very similar to an open source project in that way.
Yeah, it's a bit different than open source, but yeah, a lot of the same. I think it's probably pretty generalizable beyond that even, you know, just trying to maintain community on the web, right, on the internet in general, you run into, I bet, a lot of the same problems. So along those lines, you mentioned one thing near the end there, your thoughts on like community standards and things like that. You know, you mentioned sort of thinking about like the tone and whether it's positive. That's something that actually we think a lot about.
Yeah.
Is that something that you've had to, you know, think about or deal with on your projects?
Yeah, I would say that Appium specifically hasn't had any huge conflict between community members that has needed to be resolved with, you know, decisive action, that kind of thing. But, you know, years ago, we did put a code of conduct together, and, you know, it's hard to prove whether that's had sort of a positive effect on the way that the community interacts with each other. Probably can't prove that it hasn't either. And I would say that a lot of the tone is set by the maintainers, primarily in open source projects. And if maintainers are brusque and mean and dismissive, then that's how the community is probably going to be signaled to act. And that's not going to lead to a very friendly place. So, you know, for myself, it's often hard as I'm dealing with, you know, I'm triaging my 100th issue for the day. It's hard to be very polite and to say things again and again in a nice way. And I don't always succeed at that, of course, but I try to, and I try to encourage the other Appium maintainers to always be respectful and to, you know, assume that the person on the other end is acting the way they are because they're really stressed because they have a deadline at work. And it's not our problem, really, but, you know, they're not trying to actually take it out on us the way it sounds like.
Yeah, that's really interesting because you're both, you know, working as the community manager, I guess, in our terms, but you're also still the sort of the lead maintainer for Appium. Is that right?
Right. Yeah.
So, I mean, that adds challenge, I'm sure. It also gives you sort of, you know, you can be the role model, I guess, in a way that,
exactly,
that lets you, yeah, set the tone. Really interesting. Okay. I also wanted to get to, I've been looking at some of your recent, you know, talks that you've given and things that you've written and came across. A lot of what you're interested in and write about is sort of philosophy of technology as well. And I understand you actually have a master's degree in philosophy. Is that right?
Yep. I got that before I actually started my official career as a software developer. I had a stint in college where I decided, you know, to hell with this whole computer thing. Let's go think about the big questions. So I got a BA and an MA in philosophy, and then, of course, had to find a way to make money. So I went back to programming computers.
That's cool. But at least you have a backup career.
Exactly.
Something you can fall back on if the whole computer thing doesn't work out.
That's right.
Great. So I wanted to ask you, you've written about so many different things. I guess, what do you see as, you know, sort of right now, what are you thinking about? What do you see as some of the really interesting, big philosophical questions facing the technology industry today?
Yeah. I mean, there's questions that I see a lot of people thinking about, and I'm happy that they're thinking about it. And I'm thinking people like Tristan Harris, who are really trying to communicate sort of the dark patterns of design, you know, that companies can put into their technologies. And he has this project to try and free technology from these shackles of dark and unethical patterns, which I think is great because, you know, it's clear that technology, even, you know, technologies we think initially are benign, like forums or Facebook or whatever, can obviously be used for really nefarious purposes, sometimes even unintentionally, in the case of bias and things like that. But I tend to think about even more fundamental questions about technology. For example, what is technology? Do we even know what it is? People start talking about what they think technology is, and it's pretty clear that not very many people actually have a very coherent view of this. And the kind of default view, as I talk to fellow technologists, is that, well, technology is a tool. You know, we use computers the same way that humans used, you know, sticks to create fire, or the way that they used rocks to smash things. It's just a more advanced tool for more advanced purposes, but it's a spectrum of degree of what you can do with it, but not, there's no difference in kind along that spectrum. It's all the same thing. And I sort of don't really buy it. I think that there's a lot more going on, especially as you look into kind of the modern area, post-industrial revolution, of the pattern of technology. And I think there's a kind of stable essence to modern technology, which is very different from the way that humans have used tools all along human history. So that's some of the stuff that I'm thinking about that doesn't get a lot of airtime, because in our culture, we sort of take for granted what technology is, even though we actually have never really defined it. But it's this power that we have to do stuff with our scientific and technical understanding of the world. And then we debate a lot about, well, are we doing good things with it, without really realizing sometimes that our good or bad intentions is what we're doing conditioned by the very fabric of pattern of technology itself. And those are pretty interesting situations to think about. In some of the recent work that I did, I gave a talk on the philosophy of automation, specifically because I was talking to an automated testing crowd, and I was trying to get us all to think about, what is this thing we're doing in terms of automation? And, you know, there's all kinds of really interesting examples of how automated systems, while they take a lot of the burden away from us of doing manual labor, doing repetitive things, also increase the responsibility of humans when they end up having to deal with those systems. And when they break down, the consequences can actually be really drastic and severe. So there's a bunch of interesting questions along those lines.
Yeah, I thought what was interesting about that, this idea of sort of technology today maybe not being just a continuum from, you know, I guess like you said, rocks, banging rocks together. One of the things I thought was really interesting in that presentation, I looked through the slides, is this idea that often we want to think of tools or technology as sort of morally neutral, right?
Yeah.
Ethically neutral. You know, it's not the thing itself, it's what you do with it. The only moral actor is the person employing the tool. And, you know, technology can be used for good or evil, but it's kind of by itself neutral. And something that seemed like you were exploring there was the idea that, well, the technology actually, you know, it changes the environment in which it operates, and it changes how people operate. And so it actually has sort of this effect back on the system and on the people using
it
that has consequences. And you can't just say, well, you know, I've made this thing and I'm throwing it out in the world and we'll see how people use it. And it's not my fault if they do something bad with it. You have to actually think through the consequences of how is this going to change how people work and think.
Exactly. Yeah. And a very, you know, presumably benign example of this that we, you know, gloss over every day is a drop-down form on a website. You know, what is a drop-down form on a website? It gives you a choice between multiple options. But what that's really doing is it's putting something in the database, and that becomes reality. And the reality of that database schema is that there's only two options or four options or whatever it is. Does that actually match human reality? Oftentimes it doesn't. But then, you know, huge systems are built on top of these boxes that we've created that end up having huge consequences on human life. So the way that we track and categorize people for income tax reasons or for other kind of social programs, what ends up defining a person is these little bits of data that actually can't be reconstrued or reconstructed into who that person is. And so it's just a very simple thing that every day we're filling out forms on websites and, you know, putting ourselves in all these little boxes, which is really great for the way that databases are designed because they don't like ambiguity, but it may not be that great for the way that human beings operate. And we've all had experiences with bureaucratic systems, whether it's the DMV or other places, where you just want to shake the person in front of you and say, don't you hear the story that I'm telling you? Can't you understand that there's something different going on than what you're allowed to think about in your script? And that's, I think, part of a whole pattern of technology, not just in computers, but in the way that we're constituting our society.
Yeah, really interesting. Alexa or Matt or Joe, anything to chime in with here?
Yeah, I think there's something interesting there. There's an analog, perhaps. Well, with analog.
Yeah.
Digital is discrete. I think maybe this is sort of what you're getting at, is digital has to be discrete. Databases sort of have to be discrete. And our experience in the world is, you know, smooth curves, mostly analog experiences. And so what you're doing in the digital world is always a mapping of greater or lesser fidelity.
Right.
So maybe that's the essence of it, is that tech is still, I actually happen to believe this, that tech is still a pretty low fidelity, fairly crude thing, despite all the advances we've made. So would you say that that is analogous or getting to the idea that you're getting at?
I really like that. I think the contrast between analog and digital is really great. And I think where that goes in argumentation is, you know, I think a lot of people have this idea that once you get fine enough resolution, there's no distinction between, you know, digital reality and analog reality, to use this analogy, or between virtual reality and real reality. I also have a little bit of skepticism about that, because I'm not sure that when we construct our digital models, and I like that you use the term mapping or model, I think that we never know what we're leaving out that we don't think is important, but might actually matter. And it's always a process of eliminating reality in order to construct models. And that's really powerful. That's the power of models, and that's one of the powers of technology. But I worry about all the things that fall through the cracks in those scenarios, and what if some of those things actually are important or actually help constitute what it means to be human, and we're just not aware of that. You know, will it be too late if we go down this road for another 100 years?
Yeah, I think those things are learned very slowly, you know, and mostly by trial and error. You know, our models are guesses, right?
Yeah.
They're crude guesses. And we may or may not test how good they are. I mean, we do, but we, you know, we test them perhaps not intentionally or voluntarily.
Right, right.
Yeah. And I think about this too, when you talk about models, you know, gets into, you know, machine learning and AI, where it gets even more murky, I think, where it's no longer even a human generating the model. You're now sort of turning it over to the machine to generate the model that we sort of blindly apply because it seems to work. And we don't even necessarily even know what the model is basing its judgments on. You know, there was just a news story where YouTube was banning gaming videos by queer hosts. And their response was, we have no idea why this is happening. Like, they can't even interrogate the model to find out why it's making these decisions, because they've just, you know, handed over the judgment to a machine learning model that, you know, works most of the time.
Yeah, no, this is huge. I mean, there are all these ethical questions arising. And that's a really good point, that what we do when we hand over part of our autonomy to this system that we don't completely understand is we're making actually a moral and ethical choice for this other thing to be liable, but we don't know what it means for AI to be liable for things. The way that we can, like, tell someone who's a human being, like, hey, you messed up, you know, you should go to jail or do something.
Isn't the problem, Jonathan, that often we're not doing that, though? Like, we're focused on sort of the outcomes that we want to derive from it, right? So in the YouTube example, we want to make sure that, you know, bad stuff doesn't get distributed to our customers, and so create a system for doing that. But we don't really identify the potential unintended consequences or the sort of fail safes that we're like, okay, well, when it starts doing these kind of things, we should get alerted and should be able to step in and sort of take some action or corrective behavior. But we don't think about that because we're so focused on the outcome that we want, right? And when it does the outcome we want, we're like, good, it works. But yeah, we don't really evaluate the other part.
I think that's absolutely right. And I think to complicate things further, there's, I think, the fact that we we understand, or at least we think we understand, how other human beings operate and make choices, but we don't really know when it comes to really complicated machine learning models, if there is something that could be considered a rationale in there at all that we could ever even understand. And so it makes it hard to have a conversation and to kind of have a feedback loop and to refine and make a better system.
Yeah, and I think it's all too easy for, you know, the companies that created those models to just sort of, again, going back to seeing the technology as ethically neutral and saying, well, you know, it's not our fault. This is just, you know, the thing this tool is doing, it's the tool's fault. And, you know, we'll go punish the tool, but not really, right? Just not wanting to take responsibility for it because it's just, you know, well, it's just the side effect of this tool, even though they're the ones who created it.
Yep, totally. And the same way as, like, you know, pollution or things that have led to climate change, or, you know, companies that dump chemicals in rivers and, you know, 100 miles downstream, people are getting sick. Well, I don't know what's going on. But now we have, like, at least hopefully some kind of regulation for these things, or at least we did till recently. And I wonder if we should be thinking about that kind of stuff with respect to technology companies, which heretofore have had kind of carte blanche in terms of what they're able to do, regardless of the consequences for users.
Yeah. Really interesting stuff. Now, shifting gears a little bit, I did want to get to one other thing. I understand that you're a modern day Renaissance man. You're also a bit of a musician. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. I love music.
And you mentioned that you actually have applied this music to technology and composed a song for, I think you said, for a conference. Is that right?
Yeah. It was the JavaScript conference in Lisbon, LXJS, a while back. I had a song written that was about automation, this very topic that we were talking about, actually. And it was a story of someone who woke up in the future and everything had been automated and they were sort of depressed, actually. So it's a bit of a dystopian theme, but the point was to support a tech demo of Appium, actually. So I had Appium automating a number of different mobile devices, playing different instruments while I played guitar and sang. And so it was kind of a whole band thing. But yeah, it's a fun song.
So you wanted to demonstrate your project, and naturally you thought, I'll create a dystopian song in order to really make people excited about the future of automation.
Yeah, I can't help myself sometimes.
So you said you brought an instrument. You're going to play us a little bit?
Yeah, I did. I brought my Scarbox ukulele on my bike to the office today, so I can play a verse and a chorus of the song and give you a taste. Of course, it wasn't written for ukulele, so it now has kind of happy Hawaiian feel, which I don't know if it goes with the
I think it's
going to
work even better. Yeah.
All right, let me play a little bit for you guys.
Wow.
Amazing.
Thanks. So that's verse one. album's coming out next year.
That was really good. I like the blend of Hawaiian ukulele vibe with the dystopian lyrics.
Maybe it's a new genre.
And you have a great voice. I think now you have a third backup career. So you're in really good shape for our dystopian future.
Super excited.
Cool. Okay, so a couple more questions for you before we move on. Where can people find you on the web if they want to learn more or follow you or, you know, find your music
download
or
your album?
Anything like that?
Yes. Everyone follow me now before the album is released. So I'm on Twitter at jlips, JLIPPS. There's also jlips.com. Those are the best places. I don't do Facebook, you know, pursuant to all of the philosophical things we were talking about earlier. It's sort of one of my protest things. But I do Twitter, so I'm at least a little bit hypocritical, I guess.
Okay, great. And anything else you wanted to plug while you're here? Anything you want our listeners to check out?
Yeah, well, I mean, in addition to Soft Labs and Appium, of course, just keeping with the theme of philosophy of technology, a couple of books that I've really appreciated in recent years. One's called The Shallows by Nicholas Carr on how the style of engagement with internet content is kind of rewriting the way our brains work. It's very interesting. There's some neuroscience in there, and I don't know whether it's all true, but it's super interesting. There's another book by an author called Sherry Turkle, and this book is entitled Reclaiming Conversation, and it's more of a kind of psychological perspective on the way that devices are changing human interaction and social interaction in ways which we might be concerned about. So I leave you with those recommendations.
Thanks. We'll get those in the show notes as well so people can find those easily when the podcast comes out. Well, thank you so much. We're going to move on, but feel free to stick around and chime in on anything else we're going to talk about. Actually, our next subject is kind of related to where we were a few minutes ago talking about some of the community management and keeping the community healthy. We're going to talk to our guest, Joe Friend. Joe is the product manager of the DAG team. Joe, what does DAG stand for?
Developer Affinity and Growth. And it may not sound like it, but we thought really hard about that name, but mainly for internal reasons. I know DAG does not run off your lips, but oh well. But yeah, that's the name of the team.
Just for clarity, what parts of Stack Overflow are you responsible for? Where would people see the work of the DAG team?
Well, our core focus is on trying to increase the engagement in the community and the general health and sort of long-term viability of the community. So the engagement part can, you know, kind of span basically all of Stack Overflow and the Stack Exchange network. But, you know, sort of the place where we really focus in our testing and efforts is around the Q&A communities. And so we do a lot of work and focus on sort of that core aspect of what most people think about when they think about Stack Overflow.
So this is a continuation of the series we sort of kicked off last week talking about improving the user experience on Stack Overflow and what we're thinking about there. And we talked last week, as our listeners may remember, we read some tweets about people complaining about their experience on Stack Overflow and talked a little bit about how we can make it better. And so we wanted to follow up with you, Joe, and have you on and talk a little bit more about some of the things that your team is thinking about and looking at along those lines.
Absolutely.
So tell us about that. So tell us, what kinds of projects are you guys working on right now?
Well, you know what? We work on everything from the mundane to the sublime, as most software teams do. You know, we've done small things recently that focus on sign up and improving the sign up process, making sure people can opt into the right emails and, you know, those kind of things. But really, it's a part of our fundamental, you know, sort of core belief that, you know, users should be able to control the information that's coming to them, you know, from us. And we want to have a real respectful relationship in that regard. So that's one aspect. And then we're really honing in and focusing in an area that's really important to some of our most dedicated users. And that's, how do we make sure that the quality of the questions that are being asked is really high? And so there's sort of two sides to that. One is creating a great experience for new users when they come in so that they know what's expected and can ask good questions and succeed at that. And then the other part of it is that, you know, this makes the experience better for the people who are trying to answer questions, engage, you know, with those questions in various ways and sort of moderate and monitor the site. So those are a couple things that we're focused on. And then in addition to that, we're really looking again at the way where, how do we create additional ways for people to get meaningful content to them from the site in a, you know, sort of a way that it privately benefits them? Maybe it's not so much about the community. And this is really a key thing for, I think, new users, where they sign up and And it's sort of like, well, besides asking a question or answering a question, what can I do? What does Stack Overflow do to me? And I think for some people, it's about getting the information brought to them. And so we're looking at ways to do that.
Interesting. So tell us a little bit more about sort of thinking about the new user experience. What kinds of problems do you see users running into there that you guys are thinking about?
Well, as I mentioned, one key problem is, you know, quite a few people sign up with the intent to ask something. So having good understanding about what a good question looks like, what are the components of it, and what are the community standards around questions is important. And, you know, there's a bunch of stuff in the current product and the current experience that attempts to do that, but it doesn't seem to be quite hitting the mark at this point. And so still have a lot of people who, you know, sort of ask poorly formed or not really thought out questions. So we want to address that part. And the reason that's so important is because their perception of the community can often be, you know, sort of solidified on that interaction, right? So if I ask a question, I immediately get downvoted and, you know, have nasty, you know, comments, you know, tacked on and that kind of thing. You know, that kind of sucks. And people walk away feeling like, oh, wow, Stack's not very open. It's not very friendly. It's not inviting. And so I'm sure some of your tweets last week, you know, focused on that. I certainly see those on a regular basis, right? And so we want to turn that around. And there are, you know, like I said before, there's two sides. There's sort of changing the way the community behaves, but also giving the new users a leg up so that they can do better out of the gate. So that's one aspect of it, certainly. And then there's several other aspects we're looking at right now. Like if you don't want to ask a question, if that's not your intent, but you want to sort of participate in some other way, you want to answer or comment or help people out in some other fashion, you kind of have to jump through hoops to get enough rep to do those things. And those are in there. Those exist for good reasons, but we're sort of taking a fresh look at them and saying, how can we achieve the same goals that sort of those, for lack of a better word, barriers that we've introduced into the new user experience, those exist for a reason. How can we achieve those without sort of introducing the same kind of barriers or barriers that people can get over in a more straightforward way? So that's another area that we're really looking at.
Interesting. Jonathan, I'm curious again about this sort of overlap with your experience interacting with an open source community, and if any of this kind of sounds familiar to you, things that you think about as well.
Oh, yeah. It sounds exactly the same. I was actually going to ask about, you know, from the metrics that you all have at Stack Overflow for projects that have both a strong, you know, GitHub presence. I know not all projects are on GitHub, but let's say it's GitHub, and that have lots of questions being asked on Stack Overflow. Is there typically an overlap between those communities? And do you see in Stack Overflow, do you see topic areas having different community character? Or is it pretty much you see Stack Overflow having a certain type of community all across the board?
That's really interesting. So first of all, the first question you asked, I certainly don't have the data, you know, and sort of the association of open source projects and sort of the community that exists there, and then the expression of that that we see on Stack. But I think that that's a really interesting, man, that would be great for our data team to dig into and help us understand and learn from. We do see differences. Like if you look at the network of, you know, 170 plus, you know, question and answer sites, they have different characteristics. They have different community standards for what's a good question or, you know, sort of how do we behave in this community. And so those vary. I think it even varies, but I have less, you know, sort of less examples, even within sort of tag areas. So a tag, you know, sort of within Stack Overflow, a particular technology that maybe isn't super popular, but has a few people that are sort of really watching it and trying to help people out, they may be more open to helping someone frame their question, reframe their question or whatever, than super high traffic areas where, you know, they're seeing a lot of, you know, poorly formed questions. I think on some level, it's a natural human sort of fatigue thing. If you're, you know, trying to answer questions about JavaScript, those are coming in fast and furious. And
there's also a dynamic we see where it's sort of, we definitely see this on Stack Overflow and in different developer communities having sort of different, you know, there's a sort of big city versus little city thing that happens, which is like big technologies versus little ones. There's also sort of this dynamic of the languages that tend to be sort of entry points for new programmers have a very different dynamic than a language that tends to be favored by, you know, people with a lot more experience. So I know like Android sees, you know, sort of a lot of questions from people who are new to programming, and that presents certain challenges in that community on Stack Overflow. And some other ones where we're seeing like Python. Actually, I did a couple interesting blog posts by the data team recently on Python. And one of the interesting things was how seasonal Python traffic is, because it's become the default language in schools. Yeah. And so we see this huge spike in Python activity starting in September. And that has a real impact on that community as well.
Yeah, to the point that you're actually bringing up about kind of first time experience and all of that. I mean, I completely agree that you're looking at it as a real area to focus on, I guess. And that's super important, because someone's first experience really colors their whole understanding. And I mean, I know even for myself, I'm not a big either question asker or answerer on Stack Overflow. I'm more of a lurker. But I know that I would be a little hesitant to put up a question in an area that I was a novice in, because I do see a lot of comments that are, you know, criticizing the way that the question's asked, maybe rather than suggesting a better way to phrase it that might help the person get more answers, you know, framing it positively like that. And so I think there are probably things you guys can do to encourage the people who are really active answerers to express a criticism of a question maybe in a more productive, constructive fashion.
Yeah, I mean, I think the tone and the sort of character of the community comes through often. And that's an area where I think we need to work with a community. You know, it's like, hey, is this how we want to represent ourselves? Yeah, I know it's frustrating to have really poorly formed questions asked, but, you know, how do we as a community respond to that? And also, how do we like look at the intent of the person? Because we've kind of looked at the data, and it sort of rough back of the napkin is that we believe that well over 50% of the people asking a question really have the intent to form a good question. They just don't have the tools or the understanding of the standards, right?
Right.
So there's not a lot we can do about, you know, the people who don't have good intent, right? There's other solutions to that problem. But for the people who have good intent, let's help them as much as we can succeed. You know, I know we're talking about it being next week's podcast on mentorship experiment that we ran, but it was an idea of like, hey, we have this idea. We know it's not scalable to community the size of Stack Overflow, but let's try something and see what we learn in the process that we can make scalable. And we're going to do more and more of those kind of experiments where, hey, we don't know if this is going to work at all, but, you know, we can roll this out to some small percentage of the people coming to Stack Overflow. We can measure what happens. We can analyze it after the experiment's been run and see how it affects, you know, sort of the success of these users and their overall impression. And then we can figure out how to scale it out to the whole community. And the community is really committed to this. They look often at it from the other side, which is, I'm the receiver of all of these questions. And so how can we raise the quality? And then our team marries that with the perception of the new user and says, okay, great. Everybody has actually mostly the same, you know, desire, right? They want the same outcome. Great questions, which get great answers, right? So how do we make those work together really well? So I think it's a huge challenge. It's exciting. The team's really up for it. And we're going to do everything we can to help make a positive impact in that space.
Cool. So you mentioned the mentorship experiment, which we're going to get to next week. We're going to have Christina, our UX research lead, on to talk about that. Is there anything else that you guys are working on or that's coming soon that you can tell us about that people can look forward to?
Sure. So like, as I mentioned, we're looking at different ideas around the question quality. We're looking at trying out some new templates or new designs for the sort of the flow through that process to better guide and lead users. I know that at the core infrastructure level, there's improvements coming to search that we're excited to leverage, and that will potentially help us let users have more sophisticated ways to find duplicates before they ask. So they can find, hey, there's already a question out there and an answer that solves my problem. And right now, that's something that's hard to do for people. And we're also rolling out some new ways for us to communicate with both anonymous users who are visitors to the site, as well as our signed in users and members, so that we can better inform them about what's going on at the site and, you know, sort of information we need from them, the kind of opportunities that we have for them. So we're looking at all of those things. One other area that we're looking at rolling out, and sort of no promises on time frame, but we're looking at improving the ability to get notifications around tags you're interested in, you know, both via email and via on-site notifications. So that's another thing that we're excited to do that'll let people be able to, you know, sort of better engage with the content that's most important to them.
Really exciting. Well, thanks for coming on and talking to us about that. And we'll all stay tuned on Meta, I guess, to see those things start rolling out.
Yeah, sounds great.
Okay, so real quick, we wanted to talk about something that we just launched this week, the salary calculator, Stack Overflow Jobs salary calculator. Alexa, can you tell us briefly about that?
Yeah, sure. So we really care about transparency for developers as candidates, as they're looking for jobs. We want to make sure that developers have the information they need to actually figure out what the next great thing is for them. And we found that employers are actually not very good about disclosing salary information. So we launched this salary calculator for both developers and employers, basically as a way for us to communicate just how important it is to actually be transparent in the hiring process. And so if you go to stackoverflow.com/jobs/salary, if you're a developer, you can actually type in your location, experience, your tags that you're active on, and it's actually going to show you sort of what your market rate is relative to other developers. We used a model built by Dr. Julia, who is a frequent guest on the podcast.
Friend of the show.
Actually, she's here in Salt Lake City where I am right now. And she basically looked at our data from our annual developer survey. And so if you're a developer and you want to see what you are worth based off of your skill level and experience, check it out. And if you are an employer, a hiring manager, and you're thinking about hiring or scaling your team, and you have open jobs, you should actually benchmark how you're paying developers and take a look at that.
Cool. Yeah, it's really interesting. One other thing to call out there, some people have pointed out that the inputs are pretty limited in terms of the number of locations we have available right now. That's limited by the data we have available. But there's actually, if you go on there and you're not in one of the supported locations, you can enter your salary and we'll use that to make further improvements to the salary calculator so that we can start to actually have models for other locations that aren't covered right now. Well, thank you, Alexa. I know you have somewhere important to run to, so we'll let you go do that. All right. I think we have time for one news item.
Yes, we have a news item. This is a question on one of our sites on the Code Golf Stack Exchange. Now, what is Code Golf? Stack Overflow proper is about getting answers to your sort of practical programming questions. You're at work trying to make something happen. We have a site dedicated to the notion of sort of leisurely problem solving, abstract, difficult problem solving. And we call it golf because it's sort of like there are no consequences here, but it requires some work and it's interesting.
No, it's golf because the original challenge was a particular challenge called Code Golf, where your goal was to write the program in as few keystrokes as possible.
Interesting.
That's what Code Golf is, because the lower your score, the better.
Golf. I like the take that there's no consequences to anything in golf. That sounds like a good tip.
So the question is this. Actually, let me bring it up here to read it. It's a code challenge. And the code challenge is build a working game of Tetris. People are familiar with Tetris. But using Conway's Game of Life. Would somebody like to pipe in as to what Conway's Game of Life is from a sort of a computer science perspective?
It's like cellular automata or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'll give my quick version of this. So it's a sort of classic computer problem that has, as far as I know, almost no actual use whatsoever. Oh no, now I'm going to get angry letters from people who think it's useful. But it's sort of just a demonstration thing from the early days of computer programming that sort of emulates life a little bit. So you have this giant grid, as big as you want to make it, of cells. And the idea is that if you have these very simple rules about what causes cells to live, die, or reproduce, you create this sort of lifelike behavior of these little cells evolving and moving across your, you know, giant petri dish. And so this is just sort of a classic computer problem that at least I implemented, I don't know, in one of my first computer science courses, because it's a nice, easy thing that they can make students do. So that's most people stop there. But this particular team went quite a bit further.
So the challenge, again, to repeat, is to actually implement a game using Conway's Game of Life. So what does that even mean, you know, what to make a program out of another program? And this is just fascinating what they did here. So they wanted a Tetris solver, a Tetris player. And what they did is they took the Game of Life as a primitive, as it were, and they built abstractions on top of that so that the Game of Life itself is treated like a computer. So they start by saying, okay, how can we emulate a processor? how can we emulate memory using this crazy, as David put it, this petri dish of things moving around? How can we turn that into a thing that computes other things? So the TLDR is they just built a computer, so to speak, a series of abstractions. They started by taking this game and saying, okay, how can we make this game act like a CPU? Okay, so now we've made it act like a CPU. How do we program that CPU? So then they built an assembly language on top of that. Again, using Game of Life as the CPU. And on they went up to having a real programming language and an actual compiler for that programming language. And then and only then did they program Tetris using that language.
And it actually works. It's unbelievable. I mean, it's at the scale where you can't even run the actual thing. You can run one of their abstractions over the thing. And they describe trying to run it. And like the first time they tried to run it, it like crashed the computer because it used all available memory. And so they actually had to write it so that it would like do a certain number of cycles and then write out the results to disk and then load the next piece and compute that. But they actually provably ran this thing and it plays Tetris.
Wow.
Over something like, I forget how many billions or trillions of cells it ends up using.
Yeah, they said, I think it's a grid of, call it 3 million by 10 million pixels.
Wow. Yeah. Well, I know there's that advice when you're trying to write your first game, you know, not to go and write a game engine. And I think these people kind of went completely the opposite direction.
They did, though. I think it was not their first code challenge. This is a group of diehards, and they spent something like 2 years or a year and a half on this thing. So it's an amazing answer. Everyone should go read it. It's codegolf.stackexchange.com/question/11880, which is a conveniently memorable ID. And it's amazing. They wrote it actually as like a 8-part answer where each person wrote about their piece of it that they worked on with tons and tons of screenshots where you can see it. And it's actually very well written, describing exactly how it works. So it's really a fascinating question.
So since it's Code Golf, I think that, you know, we need a nice quiet golf clap for them, you know.
Well, at this point, it looks like he's about 5 lines away from a running compiler.
Thank you. Thank you, Matt and Joe. All right. So definitely check that out. And that's it for us. Well, you've gone and wasted another hour of your life listening to Stack Overflow podcast number 116, recorded Thursday, September 21st, 2017 at Stack Overflow headquarters in New York City. This podcast was brought to you by Oracle. Thank you to our audio engineer, Carlos Hernandez, audio editor, David Greenlee, technical concierge, Michael Rosa, producer, Jess Perdue, executive producer, Caitlin Pike. For Alexis Gordado, Matt Sherman, Joe Friend, special guest, Jonathan Lips, I am your host, David Fullerton. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
See you later.
See ya.
So where's my laughter? Where's my smile?
Podcast number wrong?
You said 117.
Oh, it was 116. Okay, that's real easy. I'll do that real quick. Well, you've gone and wasted another hour of your life listening to Stack Over Podcast number one.
Yeah, you said Stack Over Podcast instead of Stack Overflow.
Wait,
Stack
just now?
Over, man.
Yeah,
Stack
yeah
over.
Just now.
Just, did I do it wrong again?
Stack Overcast. I like that, actually.
Stack Overcast? Oh, that's a good name for the podcast. It's the hardest part, right? The outro. There's only 3 people listening by that point, and one of them is my wife. So I won't hear the end of it from her. So it's important to get it right.